And it's time to talk about Boris. So obviously, I think barring some kind of an unforeseen disaster at this stage, it seems that most people think Boris is a dead cert to be the next Prime Minister. So his critics, he's a fool, he plays fast and loose with the truth. And other people argue that he's brilliant, he has an extraordinary ability to work a crowd. And we certainly saw that yesterday at the hustings. It was extraordinary to see him in action. I'm joined now from London by Sonia Parnell, who's written a biography of Boris called Just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition. Sonia, you're welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
You have a piece in the Sunday Times today, and I think the headline probably says it all. I know too well the fire and fury lurking behind that smile. And you talk about Boris's quick temper is one of the things you talk about in there.
Yes. I mean, you know, there are many Borises. I mean, there's obviously the jovial, joke-cracking, amusing Boris Johnson that people see and who has managed to court millions of people who love him, some even idolise him. But then there's also a very different Boris Johnson who you might see in private particularly.
And you were Boris's deputy in the Telegraph Bureau in Brussels.
That's right, back in the 90s. And, this is when the Maastricht Treaty was going through. So it's sort of another kind of period of turmoil. We were working pretty hard. And you get to see someone, in all their glory, as it were, in those circumstances. I got to know him pretty well. And I also saw that temper. And it was frightening. Yeah, there's no other word for it.
Tell us about the 4 o'clock rants.
Okay, so Boris Johnson is famous, and rightly so. They were very creative pieces that he was writing from Brussels around the time that I was there. But they were very creative, and they bent the truth to the point sometimes where it snapped altogether. And, you know, actually deep down, I think Boris Johnson really is quite a sort of a sympathetic figure when it comes to the EU. So he had to try and work himself up into a little bit of a frenzy to write these things. And every day, more or less about 4 o'clock, which is why they became known as the 4 o'clock rants, he would lock himself in his office and I kid you not, and he admits this is true, shout abuse at a yucca plant, four-letter words, flying through the air very loud. You could hear it in my office next door. You could hear it in the street out loud. And he would just shout and shout and shout at this plant. And then eventually the shouting would stop and you'd hear him sit down and thump out one of these pieces at incredible speed. I mean, his focus is extraordinary. The poor Tandy laptop, I mean, fortunately it was built like a tank, so it withstood this treatment. But I remember one occasion he admitted, and I think he's admitted in print too, that the 4 o'clock rant was so sort of crazy that he pressed a biro into his palm so hard he actually drew blood. It was a very, very strange thing to witness, I have to say.
And I've seen people make the point, and Matthew Paris made it yesterday again in the Times, that this is essentially the essence of who Boris is, which is that he's a newspaper columnist who will, you know, say what he needs to say at the time with complete conviction in order to entertain, stimulate an audience, and that he's brought that into his politics.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, he is always looking for the headline, and he's always pandering in a sort of Trump-like way to his base, so he can come up with stuff that we know not to be true. He talked about, you know, the implementation period after a no deal. Well, I think, you know, most of us realise that there is no such thing, but he keeps repeating it as if it was a newspaper headline, and he doesn't expect any more scrutiny than he would as a journalist. In fact, probably rather less scrutiny. So he's using those techniques that he learnt as a columnist way back in Brussels during those 4 o'clock rants to keep people on side, that they don't press him too far, and even indulge some of the things that we've learnt about in the last 48 hours.
Now, what we have learned about them in the last 48 hours is basically that there was a row with his girlfriend at his house. Boris is refusing to answer any questions. Do you think is it having any impact on him? It certainly didn't look as if it was yesterday.
Well, again, I think it's a sort of the difference between the country at large and his base it seems now almost to the point it's a sort of a cult personality that he has, is that people refuse to think anything ill of him. If they hear something ill of him, they don't care. But I think there's a difference between that and having any credibility with the people at large, with the fact that he won't answer questions about it, the fact that a woman did sound distressed, did sort of shout, you know, get off me, get out of my flat, it is her flat and that you're spoiled, and there was a row about red wine on the sofa. I mean, these aren't great things, and for it to be so loud that people could hear it, you know, outside the flat and called the police. I mean, this isn't normal behaviour.
Did you witness Boris's temper when you work with him?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Which is why all of these years I have to say, been terrified at the idea of him in power. I did witness that temper. It was directed to me on at least one occasion.
Tell me about that occasion.
Well, I mean, it was an extraordinary thing. It was when his wife, Marina, was in labour with their first child, Lara, and she called me in tears from the labour room saying that she couldn't find Boris anywhere. Well, obviously, as another woman, I did everything I could to try and track him down. I ran around Brussels trying to find him. We didn't have proper mobile phones in those days. It was in the early 1990s. But I tried to contact him on his pager. Couldn't think of any other way. She called again in great distress. So I called the foreign desk at the newspaper in London and said, do you know where Boris is? Marina's in labour. I need to get a hold of him quickly. And then he said, oh, we didn't know she was pregnant. But yeah, he's actually on his way back to Brussels now. And so in the end, we managed to get him to the hospital on time. And the next day when he came to work, I seen that he'd be overjoyed as a father for the first time. And he directed this fury at me that I had no right to tell the desk that Marina was pregnant. And that was when I saw this extraordinary temper. I thought I'd done the right thing. I still think I'd done the right thing. Who else would have acted differently? But I had said something he'd not given me permission to say. It was pretty frightening, I can tell you.
You talk in your piece today as well about Boris, within his own family of origin, a lot of fighting and temper as well.
Yeah. His Stanley's father, so Boris's father was renowned for a short fuse. And yes, after losing a point at table tennis against his sister, I mean, he's uber competitive. He was so frustrated that he kicked the wall so hard he broke a toe. And also, outside the family, one of his former secretaries at the House of Commons told me that 80% of the time working for him was fine, even, you know, fun. But 20% was frightening because of this temper and the way that he would bang his fist down so hard on the desk, he nearly broke a bone. On at least one occasion. So this is the flip side, if you like, of the jovial Boris Johnson that you see in public.
But there is the other flip side then that you see in action yesterday, and you say it's his base, Sonia, but I guess his base is pretty big. Like it certainly takes in most of the Tory MPs, and there's huge public support from as well. I think in terms of people think that, you know, he's the guy to deliver Brexit, and he's the guy to win an election if necessary and banish Corbyn. What do you put this extraordinary popularity down to?
Well, I think, taking the Tory MPs for a second there, I mean, I think a lot of them, until very recently, were saying that, you know, they'd rather eat glass, I think one of them put it, than support Boris Johnson. But I think there was a sort of a campaign. I mean, Matthew Paris, the columnist, has talked about threatening to use private information against some of them. Some of them also see that they're going to lose their seats or think they're going to lose their seats unless Boris Johnson is in charge. So I'm not sure that you can really say he's hugely popular across the whole of the parliamentary party. In fact, I would dispute that. I think within the party members, we're talking about the figure is disputed, but somewhere between 120,000 and 160,000 Tory members who will decide whether or not he becomes the next prime minister. Well, we know from polling that they tend to be, you know, older in life, they tend to be white, they tend to be male, they tend to be quite well off, and they tend to be so obsessed with Brexit that they are prepared to trash the economy, break up the union, even see their party disintegrate in order to have Brexit. And Boris Johnson has persuaded them that he is the man to deliver it, even though actually we're still waiting for a plan and an understanding as to why he thinks he can do it when Theresa May didn't. So though obviously he is popular in some quarters, but I think he is now the Marmite politician. He wants you to be the Heineken politician. He could reach beyond the Tory party to metropolitan liberals, all sorts of people. I think that's much less the case now. He's a Marmite politician. You either love him or you loathe him, and that will be a problem for him at some point.
You mentioned the dirty tricks that are supposed to have happened in terms of getting people to vote for him. You do talk in your piece today as well about he was always a very vengeful person who wanted to punish people who crossed him, and I think we maybe saw that a bit with Michael Gove during the week.
Yes, I mean, even his own sister Rachel again describes him as very Sicilian in the way that he holds grudges, and people are quite frightened of him. I mean, I mentioned again in that Sunday Times piece the wife of a really quite eminent figure now who was in the Bullingdon Club with Boris Johnson. She said, oh, he'll never speak to you. He knows a lot, but he'll never speak to you because he's terrified of what Boris will do to you. And a lot of people have warned me to be, you know, very careful. But I cannot believe in Britain in 2019 that, you know, one should be scared. One has to speak out. I think it's a duty to do so.
A lot of people making more and more comparisons between Boris and Trump all the time. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
Yes, I think there are lots of... I think Boris takes a lot of the sort of the pages out of the Trump playbook. And in a way, he's just as talented as Trump in pandering to his base, but also just saying things that are patently untrue, such as the implementation period after a no-deal Brexit. If you say these things often enough, enough people start to believe them that you can get away with it. And this, again, is the sort of thing that Trump does.
Is there a sense at all, Sonia, though, that people think, here's a guy who's unburdened with principles, he's a guy who has been obsessed with getting into Downing Street, and that he will do whatever he needs to succeed on whatever level so that actually he could end up being a good result for people?
Yeah, no, I can see that you know, there is some strength in that argument. And I can also see that because of his genius with a crowd and getting, you know, empathising with the crowd, bringing unlikely people on side, that if somehow he could drop all these negative things about him, he could do great good. I mean, either whether you think that means implementing Brexit or you think that means stopping Brexit. This is the tragedy of Boris Johnson. He is incredibly talented in so many ways, and yet all of those talents so far have really been put to the greater glory of Boris Johnson rather than for his country.
And what about as Mayor of London? Did he not bring his talents to doing a good job at that, we're told?
Yeah, during the Olympics. I mean, during the Olympics, he was great. He really did help. It seemed such fun, such joy. I mean, he didn't bring the Olympics in, he didn't organise them, but he was part of that atmosphere in London in 2012, which we still remember as being, you know, a real golden time. But otherwise, really, during his mayoralty, even his own side said that he was a do-nothing mayor. And the problems that London has, the homelessness, pollution, congestion, really weren't tackled. He didn't bring anything new. That was very much his predecessor, Ken Livingstone, whether that was the congestion charge or the Oyster card or the Olympics themselves, or even Boris bikes, which really should have been called Ken bikes.
But Andrew Gilligan was writing in the Sunday Times last week, and he worked with Boris when he was Mayor of London. And, you know, this thing about, oh, Boris doesn't do detail. Andrew Gilligan was saying, well, like, it's not the mayor's job to do detail. It's the mayor's job to put in a good team who will do a good job. And he's about the general direction, tone and the vision thing. And Boris kind of has that, doesn't he?
Well, yes and no. If you have a look at the beginning of his term in London, and he arrived with no team in place, so a team had to be scrambled. And those first few months and even a year or so were marked by a series of sackings over sort of alleged racism and lying and resignations and even a criminal conviction amongst those people who brought in. Someone else, in the end, was parachuted in by the party to run London. Now, you know, that's one thing with a city of 8 million people altogether, another thing with a country of 65 million people.
Now, I suppose a question that we're obviously very invested in over here as well is what Boris is going to ultimately do about Brexit. Do you think that he's going to crash out no matter what on October 31st?
I mean, I don't know. And this is where, again, I think you have to be details man to be Prime Minister right now, because Brexit is all about detail. And this is why Britain has failed repeatedly in its negotiations. It was never on top of the detail as compared with Michel Barnier. I think it's impossible to know. I think though that any responsible Prime Minister, to be honest, whether it's the whole problem over the border, or whether it's medicines in the hospitals or fresh food in the shops, which responsible Prime Minister could possibly press ahead with no deal? It would be a catastrophe, both for Britain and for Ireland. I just find it extraordinary that any serious politician could even contemplate it.
OK, unless it is what the people say they want. Gerard Howland, Boris Johnson, either the best thing that could happen us in Ireland or the worst thing that could happen us?
Well, I don't see there's much prospect of him being a good thing, frankly.
You don't think that is pragmatism? You know, people say this could be the guy who could actually deliver on the withdrawal deal? Or
yeah, so there's a lot of examples in history where people who have led movements and are masters of them are actually the only ones who can effectively compromise, because they're only ones who can control most of what they have created or whipped up. So in that sense, if there could be a compromise, perhaps Boris is the only one who can deliver it. But he has walked himself into a very long, narrow cul-de-sac. I mean, I'm not remotely surprised that this is happening, because, you know, the MPs who may have wanted to eat glass rather than kiss Boris, they're facing an election of annihilation, and there's nothing like an execution to concentrate the mind. And I think a lot of that comes from there. There's all these hustings to go. We don't know what revelations will come in the coming weeks. But people should remember, I mean, compared to Lord Melbourne, Boris's morals make him look like an altar boy.
And he clearly has. I'm getting that, Sonia, you're not a huge fan of Boris, but Gerard, he does seem to have a lot of qualities that appeal to a lot of people.
He has extraordinary ability and charisma, and as regards detail and command of it, he has. His whole project is Project Boris. That is his life's work, and there has been no politician comparable to him, really, that I can remember. I mean, even the last great iconic British politician, Margaret Thatcher, she was an extraordinarily contained, disciplined person, you know, who eschewed all, you know, extravagance in personal behaviour or lifestyle. So there's nothing like this before. But I suppose the thing about Boris to remember is, and this is the critical thing for him, it will not be in October in relation to Brexit, because that's so enormous, we're understandably totally focused on it. But the bigger issue for him and for us is actually behind Brexit. It is sustainability of the United Kingdom outside the European Union. And as big as Brexit is, that would be much bigger and permanent for us.
OK, Dara.
Yeah, I just want to get in here, this idea that, and I think Jeremy Ferrier in the Irish Times write about this as well, and Michael Matul today, and this idea that Boris, with his charm, would be able to sell the current withdrawal agreement. The reality is the DUP are still going to be there. OK, the 10 votes DUP hold are absolutely crucial. They're not going to be bought off by Boris's charm. I mean, this whole idea of sticking, what's the phrase, lipstick on a pig, trying to rejig the deal a little bit, the DUP won't be bought off by Boris's charm. So I know, talking to at least a few of the Irish officials recently, they now see the possibility of no deals as almost inevitable. That's definitely not a consensus view, but there's now a sort of sense of deep pessimism among Irish officials. And again, talking to somebody who claims to know Boris's thinking, they saw Theresa May's downfall being her failure to leave in March, the end of March. And Boris determined not to repeat that same mistake, so he was determined to leave in October. The DUP are not going to back the backstop, no matter who the Prime Minister is. Mm-hmm. So Boris's charm, fantastic, but it won't. The DUP are is this.
You can imagine how that'll go down in Ballymena.
Do you not think that Boris, and this is really more of a question for Sonia, when I saw the revelations unfolding over the last couple of days, it seems to me that Boris has this self-sabotaging piece that does kick in at certain points. Like, he has had the opportunity before to move closer to the Tory leadership. And there, you know, there is a certain type of person who is very happy, you know, being in the wings and undermining the person who essentially is the man in the arena, who's the one who's holding the power. Mm. It's actually much more difficult to then occupy that space yourself, leaving aside, as you say, the Nixon and China factor that Jared talked about. And it seems to me that I've often wondered about Boris is that ultimately, despite all the bluster, despite all the emotional intelligence that he brings to appealing to his own cohort, whether he really believes himself he has what it takes. I thought there was a bit of self-sabotage going on the last couple of days.
Do you think, Sonia?
I think that's a really interesting point, actually. Yes. I mean, we saw after the result of the EU referendum in 2016 that, you know, those shots of Boris Johnson looking like a rabbit in the headlights, he looked absolutely terrifying. I do think there is an argument here to say that for him it's all about the winning. It's becoming top dog. It's about the power rather than what you would do with the power. It's about the ambition, almost for ambition's sake. So he doesn't have, I mean, like Tony Blair loved power, but always had a plan. He wanted to modernise the Labour Party, sure, but also the country. He had this sort of vision, really, even if you could say that he failed to achieve it, but he did have a vision of what he wanted to do. I think the really extraordinary thing for a politician that is Boris Johnson is what does he stand for apart from Boris Johnson? And I've known him, as I've said, since the 1990s. I still can't tell you that.
He stands for Boris, I guess, would be your opinion, would it? Funny, yeah, though, we had all these discussions around Trump as well. Oh, he doesn't really want to be the president, and when he does, it'll be... And Trump is now
running for
a second term, and all those crazy ideas he talked about, he is actually trying to follow through on all of them. Matthew Paris made another very interesting point in the Times yesterday as well. He said that he thinks Boris is starting to look uncomfortable because Boris has been forced to try and reinvent himself now as this kind of a calculator, a tightrope walker, a guy who's on detail, who's on top of it. And I thought you could see a bit of it yesterday. He's comfortable when he's cracking the funnies and entertaining the crowd, but there is that rabbit in the headlight thing you talked about when he actually needs to be serious. Jean?
I thought it was interesting. I mean, Boris Johnson's personal life is a matter of supreme indifference to me. But I think he was very optimistic in Birmingham last night when he said that people didn't want to hear about that sort of thing. I think people do want to hear.
I think
about
the crowd there
sort of
possibly didn't.
And by the sounds of the laughing and jeering that went on, they didn't. But I think that story is going to run and run. I think it's absolutely going to affect his chances and not going to probably remove him from the likelihood of being the 25th Prime Minister. But it's definitely damaged him. I think one thing that is interesting is kind of how we see male politicians versus female politicians. Like, we always talk about the charisma of Boris. And, you know, if you were told you're going to a dinner party in a few weeks' time and he's going to be one of the guests, you think, great, I'll have a great night. You might also feel uneasy about some of the comments he has made about Muslim women, about Scottish people, about...
people from Liverpool, apparently.
People from Liverpool.
Seen that?
I mean, I'm trying to think of what grouping hasn't had his ire, you know. And I think Britain has a lot of questions to answer, which it can only answer if he becomes Prime Minister, about how he represents them. I mean, there was one article, I know he is a journalist in a previous life, but you have to take it as journalistic writings because their opinion pieces were his opinions. And he made an extraordinary statement about Barack Obama a number of years ago and talked about the part Kenyan president's ancestral distrust of the British Empire. I mean, you don't have to be a psychologist or sociologist to see what he was getting at there. And I think it's troubling. Some of the things he said are troubling, but the things he does are even more troubling.
Sachin?
Well, look, I agree with what Neva said about this element of self-sabotage. But that said, I have some sympathy for any politician who has their personal life raked over in such detail. I think one of the difficulties with that kind of thing is that it puts people off politics. And we need politicians, and we need good politicians and those who aren't afraid. That said, I've no doubt that this has weakened Boris. I think it will weaken him in Europe, and I think he's not going to be taken seriously. And I think it's more trouble for the UK and more trouble particularly for the people in England who have been very disturbed by what's happened since Brexit.
Sonia, two questions to finish up on. Yesterday, I have to admit, right, I was watching Boris and there's something kind of electrifying about it. And poor old James Hunt came on afterwards, and he's a nice guy. But, you know, I've completely tuned out straight away. Has James, has Jeremy Hunt any hope at this stage?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's very hard to be up against Boris Johnson, and Jeremy Hunt does not have the personality that is in any way going to be able to compete on those grounds. I think it depends on really how people react to the stuff over about the row with the girlfriend, because, you know, it's not just that, it's about national dignity. Do we want to have a prime minister who has a row so loud with his girlfriend or ex-girlfriend, whatever that their status is, who's threatening, shouting at him to get off her or whatever? Do we want a prime minister who is known to have done that? And also, as the Sunday Times said in its front page this morning, this is a security risk. I mean, my late father used to work in government security, and I'm sure if he'd be around now, he'd be horrified. Because the thing is, if your private life is full of events, shall we put it, and perhaps events that we don't know, and there are all sorts of rumours swirling around, you are potentially compromised. It is difficult for a prime minister to have quite such a messy private life, whether or not we care about the morals of it.
Equally, if all of us were being recorded by our neighbours all the time, we'd certainly be in trouble. But one final question. The Sunday Times today also seems to have a suggestion that even if Boris makes it to Prime Minister, he could be ousted after one day, that there'll be a vote of no confidence, and that MPs will resign, and that or that there will be pressure on Theresa May not to be able to say to the Queen that Boris Johnson can form a government. Do you think, is that wishful thinking, or do you think that could happen?
I think that Britain is in uncharted territory or uncharted waters, so I think anything could happen. And if people think that Boris Johnson is going to be able to calm things down and steer a steady course through what is a national crisis, a national breakdown, I mean, we're all absolutely pulling our hair out over here, I think they will be disappointed. I don't think it's likely, but I think it's possible that that could happen.
OK, Sonia Purnell, author of Just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition, thank you very much, and we'll take a break.